21-1585, Abdurazak Yama v. Merrick B. Garland.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Hold on one moment, please.
Sure, no problem.
All right, Mr. Richards, we'll hear from you first.
Sure. Again, good morning. May it please the court, Oliver Richards on behalf of the petitioner. This case turns on a central tenet of administrative law, is that parties who have claims adjudicated by administrative agencies ought to be able to seek meaningful and effective review from an Article III court. Here, the board's decision deprived Mr. Jama of the ability to seek the review of this court in at least two ways. First, the board's decision fails to explain the basis for why it reached the decision it did. And second, the board simply failed to address a significant number of the arguments raised by Mr. Jama to it. Unless you all have specific questions or have a different preference, I'll address the first issue first and the second issue second. So first, this court's precedents are clear. In order to pass muster, an administrative agency decision, in particular the board, must explain and give a sufficient explanation that we can discern and evaluate how it reached the decision it did. Here, the board's decision fails that basic test. In essence, the board's decision consists nothing more of, albeit accurate, citations to this court's precedents and then conclusory statements that Mr. Jama failed to meet his burden. Now, what the government doesn't really defend the board's decision. It mostly just says, instead of looking at the board's decision, we should look at what the IJ decided. And it is true that the board can adopt and affirm the IJ's decision, but one thing the board's decision is clear about here is that it didn't do that. You know, the board, right here on page 2, it separated the IJ's decision into two parts. It said, well, we're going to look at the IJ's decision regarding credibility, and then we're going to look at the IJ's decision in terms of something else it characterizes as the merits. Now, looking at the IJ's decision, the IJ didn't separate his decision into these two separate parts, and indeed, it's difficult to discern what parts the board considered to be on credibility and what parts the board considered to be, quote, on the merits. The IJ's decision reached a single determination, whether Mr. Jama had proven that whether it was more likely than not he would be tortured upon return to Somalia. And on that...
Mr. Richards, help me understand. So... is there an argument to say that the immigration judge sort of said, well, assuming what he's saying is true, there's no merits? Is that a distinction that you see in the IJ's opinion?
I don't see that distinction. It certainly is not clear to me. And if we look at like pages 13 to 15 of the IJ's in the appendix of the IJ's decision regarding Mr. Jama's claim on torture based on his Christianity, there are intermingled discussions about the country conditions, and then he quickly turns to discussions about whether the IJ believed Mr. Jama had legitimately converted to Christianity. There's no separate distinction. It would be a different case entirely had the IJ said that, or had the board said, as it did in Kabede, that we're going to take everything the petitioner said as true, and then here are the reasons why it would fail even in that respect. So and throughout the IJ's decision, these credibility determinations are intermingled. For example, Mr. Jama gave testimony regarding two of his acquaintances that had also been deported, one of whom had been detained at the airport and questioned regarding his reasons for deportation by the government. That was based on his testimony, and the IJ, of course, discusses that and discounts it based on, at least in part, the credibility determination. That is certainly relevant to the merits and certainly relevant to what would happen to him if he is deported, even assuming that his claim of being a Christian is true. The same would go true for his claims regarding mental health, and this is about page 15 of the appendix, where he discusses The IJ discusses the mental health. The IJ dismisses those, again, based on credibility, largely based on his apparent belief that PTSD and depression don't constitute real mental illnesses, decisions we would say are not supported by the record and or medical evidence. But nonetheless, this credibility determination was inherent in the IJ's decision, and it is impossible, at least from based solely on the IJ's decision, to separate a credibility determination from a merits determination. The credibility determination infected the entire IJ's determination. You know, and that credibility determination was, of course, based on what we believe is clear error. The IJ asked a series of questions irrelevant to the proceedings relating to Mr. Jama's previous conviction. Almost, it seems, from reading the record, in an attempt to evaluate credibility on its own, and because Mr. Jama claimed to maintained his innocence for certain of the crimes, basically the IJ said, if you're going to say you're innocent, I'm not going to believe you, and I'm going to find you not credible, which we believe is clear error, and that issue, of course, was raised to the board, and the board said, we're not even going to address that. Fair enough. But the board then was required to explain why, ignoring the IJ's decision, why Mr. Jama wasn't entitled to relief. Of course, the credibility issue was only one of several issues raised before the board that the board didn't address. This court's precedents are equally clear, and it's just a basic tenet of administrative law that administrative agencies need to consider all aspects of a problem before reaching a decision. And certainly that includes addressing in a meaningful way the arguments raised to the board here. There were four or five points raised to the board, and the board's decision hardly addresses any of them. The first point, of course, was the credibility determination, which we know the board didn't address because the board said it wasn't going to address it. The second issue, and this is Appendix 20 to 33, where these arguments are laid out, was that the IJ had applied an improperly heightened standard. I guess you can give the board the benefit of the doubt, saying that the IJ applied the correct legal standard. But nowhere in the board's decision does it address either of the arguments that come next, which is the IJ's apparent misunderstanding of the claim regarding his clan. His claim, as very clearly laid out in the briefing below and to the IJ in the oral discussion, was that he didn't fear torture because he was a member of the R-Table clan. He feared torture by his clan because he's westernized for all of the same reasons that he fears torture by the Somali government and al-Shabaab. And the second very important point, and I just note that there's voluminous record evidence on this, of the Somali infiltration of the Somali government by members of al-Shabaab. And I understand this court has made pronouncements on that previously. I would submit that those are on a different record, and that this record here is extremely significant. And I'd encourage the court to, for example, look at the declaration of Mary Harper, who's the BBC Africa editor, and who has, to her own peril, done significant reporting out of Somalia, who says that al-Shabaab has infiltrated the Somali security and intelligence services, the Somali government, and other key institutions, and that allows it to target individuals, right? And what the IJ did was said, look, the official government policy of Somalia is to oppose al-Shabaab. And in fact, the government of Somalia is at war with al-Shabaab. But as this court has made clear, for example, Ramirez-Pero, it doesn't matter what the official government policy is. The appropriate question is whether torture is done under color of law or with the consent or knowledge of those under color of law. Governments are not monolithic, as this court recognized. Governments are made up of individuals. And while official government policy may be one thing, members who enforce of the government or those even police officers who enforce the laws may have their own views. And there's voluminous evidence in the record that even in Mogadishu, where, this court's precedents have previously said may be a safe place from al-Shabaab, that the police and security forces there are sympathetic to and, in fact, assist with targeting individuals. With that, now, just lastly, I understand that this appeal addresses certain dry issues of administrative law, and I think these are obviously very important issues. Just from an abstract standpoint, we have entrusted administrative agencies to adjudicate claims, but the administrative agencies do require oversight, and oversight by an Article III court. But even beyond those issues of administrative law, they matter here. I'm a Catholic, I've been a Catholic, and admittedly Catholicism is not a Bible-based church, but from viewing Mr. Jama's testimony, this is a man who knows the Bible extensively, certainly better than I do, and even the IJ admitted at the hearing, although he had some questions about when the conversion took place, he said, "I have no doubt that you sit here today as a Christian," right? The government's answer to this, and the government acknowledges in its brief that Mr. Jama has reason to fear his fellow Somali Muslims based on his conversion. They say, well, he lied in prison because he was afraid of retribution. Now, the government's response to his deportation appears to be, look, you should just continue to lie about your religion when you're deported and you'll be fine. Well, I find that curious. To use a kind word, but if it's also problematic because if for no other reason then there's a public hearing with public briefing of Mr. Jama declaring his Christianity, that they're all available to the Somali government, to al-Shabaab, and all of this evidence that is presented here certainly makes him a poster child for the type of targeting that would be done under Sharia law that al-Shabaab wants to enforce. And lastly, I'll just point to, although certain parts of the Somali constitution guarantee the right to practice religion, the very document the IJ appears to rely on says that's only if your religion is Islam, and it certainly prohibits conversion. So if even ignoring the al-Shabaab issues, he certainly would be targeted based on his conversion. Unless the court has other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Pennington, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Judge, and good afternoon now. Greg Pennington for the Attorney General. So I'll start with Judge Kelly's question about whether the IJ's decision can be separated into two parts, and it can. So if you look at page 57 of the record, the IJ, after noting some concerns about the testimony, says that I'm going to enter an adverse credibility finding. The judge could have stopped right there. As I'm sure the court's aware, an adverse credibility finding can be fatal to applications for relief and protection from removal for failing to meet the burden of proof. But the judge went on. Sorry, Judge, I think you were muted.
I was asking Mr. Richards to mute, but he did, so I think we're all set.
Okay, thank you. So after the judge enters this adverse credibility finding, he then spends the next two pages denying the applications based on the criminal convictions, the asylum application for the aggravated felony, and the withholding application under both the statute and the Convention Against Torture for the aggravated felony plus 5 years in prison. And then he spends a page talking about the factors he needs to consider on whether an applicant has met their burden of proof for deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture, whether there's been past torture, or whether the applicant can relocate, a pattern of human rights.
Doesn't the credibility, just the discussion of the Christianity and whether or not he would reveal his newfound religion when he returned, it just does seem like there is a bleeding into, if we're going to call it the merits conclusion, a bleeding in of the credibility. And could you respond to that? I mean, I know you're walking through different parts of the opinion, and I understand that, but when you get to sort of the guts about Christianity and what would happen to him, I don't know how you take out the credibility determinations.
Well, Judge Kelly, if you look at the language the immigration judge uses, he says, and this is talking about whether he's going to outwardly express being Christian, he says, "I do not find that compelling." And so, as the Supreme Court recently recognized in Garland v. Dye, the immigration judge doesn't have to find testimony plausible or believable or sufficient to meet the burden of proof, irrespective of an adverse credibility finding. So I think that's what the immigration judge is trying to say here. I simply don't find your testimony sufficient to show that you're actually going to go and profess yourself to be a Christian. And then the next sentence or two, the judge goes on to say, give me a second to get my place here. "The court does note that in the country condition documents that certainly, if it were to come to light that he is converted, that he would face harassment, discrimination, inability to find a job, stigmatization, significant prejudice, problems finding work." The judge goes through and recognizes that, okay, assuming that you do say that you're Christian, you're going to be in a bad place, but you're not going to be tortured. And I would remind the court that torture is a very specific term in the regulations that requires someone to be in the custody or control of a government official and then be subjected to cruel and inhumane treatment, or that it happens by a private individual and a government official breaches their legal responsibility to intervene. So I do believe that while I can say that there might be an argument that the judge was looking, and the judge even references his adverse credibility finding from the previous section as to why he was not persuaded that Mr. Jama would come out, the judge did consider in the alternative, if it does come to light, if you do profess your Christianity, you're going to be in a bad place, but it wouldn't amount to torture. So, and then, you know, the judge goes on to consider the rest of Mr. Jama's claims on the merits. So the government does believe that there is separation between the adverse credibility and the merits. And as this court held in Kadibi, you know, the board doesn't have to address an adverse credibility finding in every case. You know, only occasionally where it's so intertwined. And it cites to a decision where a judge required corroboration based on an adverse credibility finding. So I can see that being intertwined here. But here, the immigration judge seemed to adequately separate it into two separate holdings. And those holdings rest on a premise that is well recognized in this court's precedent and in board precedent, that speculative testimony about what's going to happen. Mr. Jama has no foundational experience about what happens to Somalis who are deported. So all he's left with is country condition evidence. And this court has also held that just broad country condition evidence of human rights abuses is insufficient. There has to be an individualized risk of torture by a government official or with the government official's acquiescence. So taking that, the board did not err and not addressing the adverse credibility finding. And then responding to Mr. Oliver's other arguments, that he raised that the immigration judge misconstrued his Klan argument. So the board specifically said in this last paragraph of his decision, it recognized his arguments that the immigration judge misconstrued his claims. And that's exactly how he put it in his appellate brief to the board. And it responded that it did not find those persuasive. You know,
how is that enough that just we're not persuaded? What are we as the court reviewing the agency determination? What are we supposed to do with it? How do we know?
Well, this court requires that the board show that it looked at the arguments and it responded to them and didn't merely react. It doesn't have to write a tome on every argument raised by a petitioner. We just have to know.
Well, this is certainly not a tome. I mean, this is pretty much the opposite. I mean, I think we can all agree on that aspect of it, but this is something, you know, a little closer call.
I would agree, and the board is not known for being artful drafters of eloquent opinions. Most of its decisions are short. But here, looking at the meat of the claim, the board did not err because the immigration judge did not err. The board says it considered its argument, and if you look at the immigration judge's decision, at page 60 of the record, the judge goes into why Mr. Jama fears torture, and he says, number three, that he would be tortured, Mr. Jama would be tortured, because he is a member of the Artable clan, and it will torture him for being Christian, as well as him speaking Pidgin English, or Pidgin Somali, excuse me, having tattoos, and that the government will somehow acquiesce to this torture. So that's at page 60 where the immigration judge recognizes his claim that he's a member of this clan, and his clan will torture him for the reasons he's set forth. And then at page 62, the immigration judge rejects that after going into a long discussion about how it's simply based on speculation. He has no experience with his clan. He doesn't speak to members of his clan or his extended family in Somalia. So he just has no experience. And so it's based on his own speculation of what he thinks might happen. And that's just simply not enough under any court's case law to show that an individual faces a more than likely not chance of being tortured. And then on top of that, that the government's going to acquiesce in it. So, and, you know, Mr. Oliver cites this journalist's declaration, Mary Parker, and, you know, she goes through some of this. Like, she calls them the lost ones and how they are ostracized and they have trouble finding work. Some of them wind up in, you know, IDPs, internally displaced persons camps. That's all awful. Nobody wants to go through that, but we're looking at torture here. And he just hasn't presented any evidence that he's going to be at risk of something that meets the definition of torture under the regulations. And I will also, he claims that the board did not address the infiltration argument. You know, as I said in my brief, the board held that he failed to show that the government would acquiesce. I think that the infiltration argument is part and parcel of acquiescence. But he cites also that declaration of Mary Harper to show that the government has infiltrated the government or the federal government of Somalia. But if you look at that declaration, Ms. Parker also states that these might be government officials by day and Al-Shabaab by night. And that seems to imply that, you know, they're not acting under color of law, outwardly saying that they're Al-Shabaab. And that's what acquiescence requires. It requires a public official acting under color of law breach their legal responsibility to intervene in torture that they know about. And there's just no evidence in the record that these infiltrators are doing that or torturing its citizens. So,
Mr. Pennington, can I follow up on a question that you were talking about, that you're addressing the two claims that he alleges that weren't addressed by the BIA? The first one, as to his torture by members of the clan, do you believe that that one was misconstrued or that the BIA addressed that one? I'm not sure I understood your answer on who he would be subject to torture by.
So the board's decision, and this is at page 4, at the top of the page, it acknowledges all of the claims that he put forth before the immigration judge. And it does say, because he is a member of the Artable clan. So, admittedly, it doesn't say that he claims he's going to be tortured by fellow members of the Artable clan. But, you know, as an appellate body, it's looking to the arguments raised. And the argument raised was that the immigration judge misconstrued the claim. And the board rejected that, and as I explained, that the immigration judge did not misconstrue the claim.
And tell me again where in the IJ's opinion you believe it did not misconstrue the claim?
So at page 60 of the administrative record, the immigration judge goes through in numbers.
I'm sorry, when you're saying 60, I have the addendum. Is it in the addendum? Is it the opinion you're referring to, the IJ's opinion?
It's the immigration judge's opinion, and I can pull up the page number of the judge's opinion.
If you can just point me to that.
So this page would be page nine of the judge's opinion.
Okay.
And it would be middle of the top of the page, the paragraph that continues from the previous page. It says number three, that he would be tortured because he is a member of the Audible clan, and there's obviously...
So I read that one, and... Okay, so you're saying that there's a typo, because I think that what the understanding of that is that he would be tortured simply because he's in the clan and for being a Christian, not that he would be tortured by the clan, his own clan. You're reading it as a typographical error that one should infer that it means he would be tortured by his clan?
I would say that there, and it will torture him. Because that's the way he presented it to the judge, is that these clan members aren't going to like him because he's westernized and his own family treats him that way here in the United States, he said.
Okay, so, right, and I think his argument that is it was misunderstood, and that's where I'm trying to get at what your position is regarding whether it was misunderstood.
I would say that the record shows that the immigration judge considered his argument as it was presented. So what we really have here, and... you know, Mr. Oliver doesn't really get into the evidence, but we have two competing bodies of evidence. We have the country condition evidence submitted by Mr. Jama, which shows human rights abuses and atrocities by Al-Shabaab. And we have evidence submitted by the Department of Homeland Security, which says that, you know, Mogadishu is a relatively safe place and ordinary civilians aren't targeted, and that the federal government in Mogadishu works with the UNHCR and other international agencies to bring back refugees who have sought asylum in Kenya and Yemen. So that's not the point of substantial evidence review in this court. The court's not here to reweigh the evidence. It's only looking to whether a reasonable judge could make the decision the immigration judge made here. The record supports that decision, so we would ask that the petition for review be denied. I would just note in passing that Mr. Jama was removed to Somalia a little over a month ago.
How is that relevant?
I just didn't know if the court wanted to know, but he has been removed. I mean, it doesn't moot his Convention Against Torture claim or anything. I just, as a point of information.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Richards, we'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Sure, thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple points. The government appears to, I mean, the government understands that it's not this court's job to reweigh the evidence, but that's precisely what they appear to be doing. A majority of their brief is addressing the evidence and inviting this court to ignore what the board actually decided in favor of what the government thinks the board should have decided. Now, just addressing the points raised, first off, the statement that he found Mr. Jama's testimony not compelling. I don't know any other way to understand that statement other than a statement about credibility. There is a statement in the record that Mr. Jama says, I will not keep this a secret any longer. I can't keep it a secret. Assuming that evidence is true, the IJ probably would have reached a different conclusion. I want to move on to the board's statement that we are not persuaded by this. The statute gives the IJ the ability to make fact findings. The IJ is supposed to make fact findings. And frankly, the contention that the IJ made fact findings on the claim as presented is just meritless. And if you look to, and I understand there's some difference about page numbers, I was citing the pages of the addendum, but if you look to page 62, where the IJ addresses this claim based on his clan, I'm quoting directly from the opinion, So there's no reason that this court can find that the respondent would be targeted for his membership in a clan. The IJ misunderstood the claim and made no fact findings relevant to the claim. It is not the board's ability, the board's not job to make those fact findings in the first instance. And certainly, if it were going to make fact findings in the first instance, it should explain what facts it's finding in order for this court to conduct a substantial evidence review. Lastly, you know, I just want to address a brief statement made by my opposing counsel about the Mary Harper declaration about government officers by day and al-Shabaab by night. That's just the argument there is just contrary to this court's case law, particularly in the Ramirez-Peyro case. This government, this court addressed, you know, claims related to Mexican police officers and whether and corruption. It simply cannot be, and it's not the law that that claim of acquiescence is based on official government policy. So if the government is indeed conceding that these police officers may be al-Shabaab by night, it's you know, which is what the evidence shows, you know, and that they target these individuals and point them out to al-Shabaab, then I think that's very relevant here. And there's just real no question that torture includes, you know, killings. And Mr. Drama, as I said in my opening, is a poster child for an apostate and would certainly be targeted. And with that, thank you for the court's time, and thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your argument. Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted. The court will file an opinion in due course.